the last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Well, we had John Hayes with us earlier in the programme, and as I said, his teammate from the 2009 Grand Slam winning team, Rob Kearney, is with us now. He has a new book out called No Hiding, and of course, Rob didn't just win the Grand Slam in 2009, he won it again in 2018. Four Six Nations titles, four European Cup titles with Leinster, also six Pro 14 medals, and 95 caps for Ireland, played for the British and Irish Lions, over 200 appearances for Leinster. And as we'll talk to him in a little while, he's off to Australia next. Rob, thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Last Word of Today FM.
Not at all. Thanks for having me on the show.
Rob, the book is fascinating in some respects, nominated for the Sports Book of the Year category in the forthcoming Irish Book Awards. But reading it, it struck me that you would have in any other profession possibly grounds to take an action against your employer for workplace bullying. And that in particular applied to the way Michael Checa, when he was Leinster coach, treated you. Tell listeners a little bit about the way that he used to pick on you.
Yeah, I think it was probably, you know, it was a long time ago now, and there was different sort of behaviours in the workplace. I think sporting environments and sports teams, they are different to your office as per se, and people do get treated differently. But I suppose I wanted to highlight a little bit just how I found I got treated a little bit harshly in my earlier years when I went into the Leinster setup.
Yeah, in what way? Just explain what he used to do to you.
I think it was probably the video analysis reviews on a Monday morning, where they would just, my sort of errors and mistakes would be showcased and heavily penalized an awful lot more than anyone else. I was the new kid in, and I think it seemed as if I was probably just the easy target for him and someone to pick on.
Did you ask him why he did that?
I didn't. And you know, looking back now, I regret not confronting him about it and trying to understand what the issue was. I suppose I was just so happy to be in the door of Leinster Rugby, doing something that I wanted to do since I was 5 or 6 years old, and I didn't want to ruffle any feathers or step out of line with the off chance that I might get booted back out the door as quick as I came in.
But did you start making assumptions as to why he was doing this to you? Was it that you felt that, well, he's trying to make me a better player? Or did you fear that he was trying to undermine you so that you might walk away and he could pick somebody else in your place?
No, you know, I've done lots of thinking about it, and I suppose the only conclusion that I can come to was that perhaps I came out of school and straight into the Leinster setup, and, you know, I had a little bit too much of a swagger for his liking, that maybe he wanted to see a young kid coming out of school, putting his head down, being humble, working hard, and just getting along the journey with his own business, where, you know, I was probably, you know, came in just expecting to walk out of the team. And I might have had an air of cockiness in my earlier years that he didn't really seem to enjoy.
Yeah, but isn't there a way of dealing with that, such as having a conversation with somebody rather than actually going the sort of army boot camp approach?
Yeah, listen, I'm not trying to defend his treatment of me in any way. I'm just trying to, I suppose, process and draw some conclusions as to why I might have been on the receiving end of some of that treatment.
So there are people who say maybe the ends justified the means, that by the time Checa left Leinster, you were a Grand Slam winner with Ireland, you'd won a European Cup with Leinster, you'd started full back on the British and Irish Lions team. So he could say maybe that tough love did the job for you.
Yeah, well, you know, you always try and take some positives out of these things. And while there was many days in my earlier years that I didn't enjoy and I was very apprehensive about going to work on a Monday morning, I do think that, you know, some of that tough love that he gave me, that it's sort of enabled me to have a little bit of a mental resilience down through the latter years.
And how then did Joe Smith differ in his approach when you had him as coach first at Leinster and then with Ireland?
I think Joe was very much in, you know, I was more of an established player when he came in. I'd just come back from a Lions tour, so I wasn't the young kid in the team anymore. I was the established player who'd been there for a long time. So I think straight away you're operating on a different sort of level of respect between coach and player that I never really got from Cheka. And, you know, certainly when I look back on my time with Joe, it's all very positive.
Is it all very positive? Because I get the impression as well, though, that there still was a certain degree of fear of Joe Schmidt's video analysis, in the same way as that Michael Cheka used to pick on you. Joe Schmidt picked on everybody and ran the risk maybe at times of humiliating people by picking apart their shortcomings in front of the collective group.
Yeah, you do have to have thick skin in some of those video review sessions. I think the thing with Joe was that we were winning so many games and we were winning so many trophies under him that we all just sort of accepted that this is a means to an end. And if we put up with some of these video reviews on a Monday morning, it's going to make the team better and we'll win the game on Saturday afternoon, which is ultimately everyone's sole purpose.
But did it actually make the team better? Again, could these reviews not have been done privately? Like in most workplaces, if somebody is not performing properly, they get called aside privately and words are had. It's not done in front of all of the other workmates where there is a potential for things to go badly wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the big cultural differences between a sporting environment and an office. It's a very honest, open environment. Like I say, you need to have a thick skin and there's learnings for everyone in it. If a coach is having a go at me, it's, you know, to sort of educate every other member of the squad as well.
But is that not perhaps at times a limited approach, a very one-dimensional approach, school teacherish, as if adult men, and we're talking about men's professional rugby here, have to be treated like school children, disciplined into a particular way of doing things?
Yeah, you know, there's a very strong argument that you're right. But I suppose for us as players, we were sort of prepared to put up with it because we knew we were getting the success on the weekend a lot of the times.
Yeah, but did Joe Schmidt actually make you a better player? Because it is interesting in the book how you talk about looking back at a video of what I thought was some of your best performances as well on the Lions Tour in 2009, where you were absolutely flying brilliant form as a dynamic attacking fullback. And instead, under Joe Schmidt, perhaps we came to see you more as ultra reliable and defensive and not as much of that attacking flair as once we associated with you.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's, you know, necessarily all down to the coach. I think the game has changed significantly since 2009. And I probably had changed a little bit as a player too. Defenses were much harder to break down. And the things that I was able to do back then, you know, I just simply wasn't able to do towards the latter years of my career.
Because your body wouldn't let you, is it?
Well, just because I'd gotten a little bit older. I had a few injuries down through the years. And I think defenses is another key component of it, that there just wasn't the same amount of space as there had been back when I started out.
Can experience as well, though, sometimes inhibit you in that you understand more what could go wrong and the sort of the naivety and the innocence of youth is gone?
I think 100%. And that's something that that definitely weighed heavily on me. The older I got, I started to appreciate and understand the importance of making less and less mistakes. And, you know, I write about in my book that towards the end of my career, that I was very much 51% goalkeeper, 49% attacker. And, you know, you can argue for and against both, but I just felt that sort of philosophy on how to play rugby suited my game.
Yeah, but is that then a culture that Joe Schmidt brought into Leinster and Irish rugby? This sort of no mistakes, if at all possible, that it didn't, although it got a lot of fantastic results, it may not have got the results where they were really needed, such as the 2015 and 2019 World Cup, and didn't bring the best out of players.
Well, I can only speak on behalf of my own personal experiences. I think, you know, Joe got the best out of me as a player, particularly in, you know, early on in his career in 2000, 2013, 2014, you know, I think that was a period of time when I was playing my best rugby. I went through some difficult times in 2016, 2017. And then I came back with a little bit of a bang in 2018 and had a almost a rejuvenation of my own performances.
The reason I ask you that, and I don't want this to be misinterpreted in any way, because when I worked with Jamie Heaslip on his book, and Jamie was, again, like yourself, very deeply appreciative of all of what Joe Schmidt did for his career. But Jamie also took great enjoyment out of the brief time that he had with Stuart Lancaster at Leinster, having a more expansive approach to playing his game. Did you ever get that on other occasions away from Joe Schmidt, where perhaps you were allowed to do that a little bit more?
Yeah, listen, I was very much struck by the type of game that Stuart Lancaster wants to play. I think he's a superb coach. I talk in detail in the book how I'm not necessarily his type of fullback, but I still see a huge amount of value in the skill set that he has as a coach. I think, you know, it's important to note as well that provincial rugby and international rugby, they're two very different games, and you can play a specific type of game plan at provincial and club level that might not necessarily play to your strengths as an international team.
So tell us about the move to Australia. Why have you decided to prolong your rugby career?
I suppose I found this last season quite unfulfilling. You know, I haven't played a huge amount of games. I think I've only played three or four times in the last 9 months. Having no crowds, getting no sort of send-off, it made the end of my career just not exactly the way that I wanted to finish up. And this opportunity came to go to Western Australia and do 6 months in Perth. And it seemed like the perfect fit for me to go and try something different and experience a new culture and a new club.
So is that as much a lifestyle choice as a rugby choice?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I've been in Leinster rugby for 15 years now, and Dublin and Leinster is all that I know. And I'm acutely aware that there's a big world outside of Ireland and outside of Dublin. And it was always my intention when I finished up to maybe go away and do some traveling. You know, so when an opportunity like this came up to play rugby and to do a bit of travel and live somewhere else, it seemed like just a really good fit.
Yeah, how fortunate do you feel that you've actually had time to consider the likely adjustment to life beyond professional sport? Because unfortunately for many players, they end up in situations whereby they get injured and their careers are ended prematurely, and they may not have thought out or prepared properly for what happens in the future.
Yeah, I think, and that's why in some respects I'm lucky that lockdown came at a time for me to really reassess and get to grips with the potential transition away from the game that I'm going to be embarking on. You know, I've always tried to establish a dual career away from rugby. I've done my degree, I did my MBA in DBS as well. So I've always been aware to make sure that I've got other things going on in my life outside of rugby that I can potentially move into when the time does come to finish up.
But there is a very interesting line in your book in relation to that, in which you say, there is interest there, but not the love or passion. Now, that's really interesting, because does that give you a certain degree of foreboding as to the future, that you may not find something to do in the future that's going to be as enjoyable as what you've done in your adult life to date?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, playing rugby for Ireland and Leinster was the only thing that I've ever wanted to do since I was 5 years of age. I've lived that dream. It's been my passion since I was a young kid. And now that's been taken away from me. So I think there has to be an element of accepting that the next 34 years may not give me the same amount of buzz that the previous 34 have. But, you know, I'm also, you know, very sure that I'll find other passions in some different areas of my life, but they may not just give me the same level of satisfaction that playing rugby did.
And are there standout moments from your career that gave you more satisfaction than any others that you think you'll remember for all the rest of your life?
I think, you know, if I had to pinpoint one year in my whole career, it would have been 2018. I'd gone through some difficult periods in 2016 and 17 with injury, with form, with selection. And I suppose a lot of people were writing me off during that time. So to be able to come back in 2018 and play some good rugby and win a lot of big games with both club and country is very personally satisfying for me.
Okay. Earlier on, off air, I asked John Hayes, is there anything I should put to you? And he suggested I should ask about your nickname, Handsome Rob. How did you react to that moniker from your teammates?
To be honest, I've been called a hell of a lot more worse down through the years. So when the lads decided to nickname me that, I certainly wasn't complaining too much.
Of course, there was also a Twitter account, wasn't there, sort of slagging off yourself and your brother Dave as well, has been a sort of a parody on being the most exciting people in Irish rugby. How did you deal with that?
Unfortunately, it's still alive and active and going very strong. You know, for the first couple of weeks, I was so rattled by it. I tried to get it closed down. I tried to contact who it was. I couldn't believe that someone was out there putting such character defamation into the global world of media. But I've come to love it now. We both Dave and I enjoy it. We've good crack about it sometimes. And I did go very hot on the hunt to find out who the man behind it was. And I'm very pleased to say that I found him a few years ago.
Oh, did you? And what happened when you found him?
I haven't done anything to him yet. But he knows that I'm always watching, and that if he steps too far out of line, there'll be a little reference to his name somewhere.
So you're not going to tell us live tonight who actually is responsible for the account?
I won't. I'll tell you where he's from. He's a Mullingar man.
It's not Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, is it?
It's not, thankfully. I wouldn't like to get on his bad side.
Okay, listen, Rob Carney, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and talk about your new book, No Hiding.
Thanks for having me on the show, Matt.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.